And so with that short introduction, then we welcome our brother Duncan to speak to us on the subject of Psalm 15, Psalms Considered.
We'd like to begin by trying to place this 15th Psalm in its historical setting. I think if we can do this, then we will be in a position to appreciate the reason why its accredited author, David, composed it. Psalm 24 helps us greatly in our inquiries because we find that the expressions found in our 15th Psalm are replicated, albeit in a reduced form, with the five verses of Psalm 15 condensed into just three verses. Let's turn to Psalm 24, and the passage we have in mind commences at verse 3. Psalm 24, verse 3. The two questions are asked. Who shall ascend into the hill of the Lord? Or who shall stand in his holy place? He that hath clean hands and a pure heart, who hath not lifted up his soul unto vanity, nor sworn deceitfully, he shall receive the blessing from the Lord and righteousness from the God of his salvation. Notice that in verse 3, the question, who shall abide in thy tabernacle, which we read in Psalm 15, the question is put slightly differently. Who shall stand in his holy place? The suggestion is that in Psalm 24, the psalmist is especially concerned about bringing the ark up to Zion to its resting place. That the second part of this Psalm 24 goes on to describe the progress of the triumphal procession, marked by the urgent cries of the gatekeepers, suggests that it was written to mark the joyful occasion described in the book of Samuel, when David danced before the Lord with all his might. So David and all the house of Israel brought up the ark of the Lord with shouting and with the sound of the trumpet. And for a God-fearing man like David, the safekeeping of the ark was all important. Psalm 132 expresses David's longing to bring the ark up to Jerusalem. Psalm 132, and we will read from verse 3. The expression of David for the ark. Surely I will not come into the tabernacle of my house, nor go up into my bed. I will not give sleep to mine eyes or slumber to mine eyelids until I find a place for the Lord, an habitation for the mighty God of Jacob. Soon after Jerusalem was captured, David arranged to fetch the ark from Kirjath-Jearim. But the first attempt ended, as we know, in disaster. Asa was punished with death. He was punished for putting forth his hand to steady the ark being transported on a new cart. Asa had flagrantly usurped the duties of those Levites appointed for such a work. And it's quite clear that the breach of Asa troubled David. We're told that David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How shall the ark of the Lord come to me?" Because it was imperative that God's instructions be carefully heeded. And so the two questions raised in verse 3 of Psalm 24 needed to be addressed before the joyful procession the psalm goes on to describe could become a reality. It has also been suggested that Psalm 15 was written later on, after the ark had arrived at Jerusalem. You remember that Zadok was the high priest appointed to stand in the holy place. He was given access into the new tent that David pitched to house the ark. And Psalm 15 may even have been composed to mark Zadok's consecration. You will recall that when Aaron and his sons were consecrated, Moses took the blood of the ram of consecration and sprinkled it on the tip of their right ears, the thumbs of their right hands, and the great toes of their right feet. So it is very interesting to find that Psalm 15 refers to many parts of the human body, either directly or by inference. We have allusions to the feet for walking and standing, to the hands for working, and to the heart, and to the mouth, and to the tongue. Now there are other psalms, apart from the two that we've looked at, that are associated with the arrival of the ark at Jerusalem. We have in mind Psalm 68, 87, 105, and 132. But Psalm 15 considers the essential spiritual conditions that must be complied with before we ourselves can obtain permanent acceptance. So I'd like to now look at the structure of the five verses that make up Psalm 15. Psalm 15, structure and summary. Now, when you read the psalm, you will see that the psalm opens with two related questions. And the questions are initially answered in general terms in 3 verse 2. And these general answers are then expanded in verses 3 to 5. And just like verse 2, the final three verses are also made up of three clauses each. So there is a wonderful symmetry to the overall structure of the psalm. And the concluding sentence in verse 5 pronounces on the godly man blessings of stability and permanence. And what particularly strikes us about this psalm is its brevity and the economy of language used. Because compressed into just five verses is a wide-ranging review of the life of a true citizen of Zion. And the reader ourselves included, the reader is able to test the genuineness of his own spirituality. Now, you remember that the ark is described in the second book of Samuel as the ark of God, whose name is called by the name of the Lord of hosts that dwelleth between the cherubims. So the ark became the recognized focus of God's presence among his chosen people. And so the presence of the ark inside the new capital city, City of David, the ark made that city of Zion, made it holy. Remember how David expressed his craving in Psalm 27. He said, "One thing have I desired of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to behold the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple." God's holy hill and the tabernacle, or the tent, they came to dominate David's mind. And that's seen in the two key questions that open this 15th psalm. The two related questions. Lord, who shall abide in thy tabernacle? Who shall dwell in thy holy hill? There is a significant difference between the words abide and dwell. The former suggests a temporary sojourn, whilst the latter suggests something much more permanent. And so the Revised Standard Version reads, "O Lord, who shall sojourn in thy tent? Who shall dwell on thy holy hill?" And George Booker writes in Psalm Studies, "There is a progression here in the two questions. It is one thing to stop as a stranger and rest for a moment in God's tent. It is quite another, conditional on fulfilling all the spirit of this psalm. It's another question to be allowed to settle permanently in God's holy hill of Zion." And I think we should emphasize at this point that at this time, God's temple was still future. There wasn't a substantial brick building that was erected in Solomon's day. The temple was scaled down to just a tent, a simple one-room enclosure. Because how else could David have gone in to sit before the Lord after Nathan announced God's covenant to him, unless it was such a simple tent construction? So we ask, does that first question apply to the newly installed king who has just brought the ark up to Zion? In which case, does the second question anticipate the future kingdom, the time when David's house is established forever? Because Psalm 61 records David's prayer for the future, His prayer was that I will abide in thy tabernacle forever. He shall abide before God forever. So those are the two questions that are asked at the beginning of the psalm. So our overhead sets verse 2 in the context of the questions raised in the opening verse. And what we can call general answers cover our walk, our work, and our speech. He that walketh uprightly. When we walk, we're on a journey towards a known destination. There has to be coordination of all body parts to achieve balance and movement. And we recall the walk of faithful men of the past. For example, in the antediluvian world, it is said of Enoch that he walked with God. The opening psalm pronounces a blessing on the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, for the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous. And similarly, in Psalm 101, David says, I will behave myself in a perfect way. I will walk within my house with a perfect heart. He that worketh righteousness. This active quality of doing what is right and fair does not come naturally to any of us. Something we had to labour hard to attain. It's interesting that Paul seems to be quoting directly from Psalm 15 when he told Cornelius, of a truth I perceive that God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation he that feareth him, and these are the words from Psalm 15, and worketh righteousness, is accepted with him. That's marvellous, really, isn't it? So in Peter's address, he was drawing on the instruction of our psalm. God is calling from the nations, he that feareth him and worketh righteousness. And then he that speaketh the truth in his heart. New International Version, who speaks the truth from his heart. The upright man is not two-faced. What he says is what he thinks and believes deep down in his heart. I'd like to turn to Isaiah chapter 33. And we want to note how in verse 13 onwards, there are striking similarities with our Psalm 15. So we have again two questions answered by practical examples to show what righteousness and uprightness involved. So this passage in Isaiah seems to be modelled on the structure of this 15th psalm. We'll just read from verse 13 of Isaiah chapter 33. Hear, ye that are far off, what I have done, and ye that are near, acknowledge my might. The sinners in Zion are afraid. Fearfulness hath surprised the hypocrites. Here we have the questions. Who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings? The answer, He that walketh righteously and speaketh uprightly, he that despiseth the gain of oppression, that shaketh his hands from holding of bribes, that stoppeth his ears from hearing of blood, and shutteth his eyes from seeing evil. And such a man, Isaiah says, will obtain a permanent blessing. Reading on at verse 16. Such a man, he shall dwell on high, if you like, on Mount Zion. His place of defense shall be the munitions of rocks. Bread shall be given him. His waters shall be sure. Thine eyes shall see the king in his beauty, and they shall behold the land that is very far off. And then verse 20 refers to Zion and to the tabernacle pitch there. Verse 20, the prophet invites us to look upon Zion, the city of our solemnities. Thine eyes shall see Jerusalem, a quiet habitation, a tabernacle that shall not be taken down. Not one of the stakes thereof shall ever be removed, neither shall any of the cords thereof be broken. It's the idea, isn't it, of a tent which housed the Ark of God. So we now want to move on to verse 3. We've looked at the general answers given to these two questions in verse 1, but now we come to more specific aspects. So we now move on to consider the third verse. And on our overhead, we've broken the verse down into its three component clauses. Clauses all concerned with speech and results of those things that we say. So we can say that we're now looking at practical illustrations of those broad issues already defined in the previous verse. So we start. He that backbiteth not with his tongue. New International Version. Who has no slander on his tongue. Although a little member, the tongue boasts great things. And James exclaims, the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. It is an unruly member, full of poison. Nor doeth evil to his neighbour, or Revised Standard Version, doeth evil to his friend. Think back to Israel's wilderness journey, the murmurings in the camp, because what was said privately inside the tent soon spread like wildfire to stir up the people against Moses. And that's why we have the injunction in the book of Leviticus that thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, neither shalt thou stand against the blood of thy neighbour. So that's a practical illustration of just what a loose tongue can lead to. Nor taketh up a reproach against his neighbour. This word reproach is derived from a root word used to describe the stripping of trees of their fruit. So when we slander our brethren and sisters, we are, in effect, doing just that. We're stripping away their virtue. And how we love to spread and to listen to gossip. Like the game of Chinese whispers, the malicious story gets more and more embellished and changed by readily accepting by what we hear, by not checking out the facts for ourselves, we can easily reproach our neighbour and we can do untold damage. You just have to think the trouble that Mrs. Biko, the wife of the Speaker of the House, got into. Her social networking, and she spread through something that was completely false. And she's now facing the consequences and legal action from the offended party. As Paul wryly comments, if ye bite and devour one another, take heed that ye be not consumed one of another. Then we move on to verse 4. In whose eyes a vile person is contemned? Other versions, in whose eyes a vile person is despised. Think of Mordecai. Think of his estimation of wicked Haman. It's a classic example of what this clause means in practice, because Mordecai resolutely bowed not, he refused to show Haman reverence. And that was because in Mordecai's eyes, Haman was a vile person. And in an increasingly wicked world, how we view the reprobate will be a measure of our spirituality. Do we then set a distinction between the godly and the wicked, between him that serveth God and him that serveth him not? David says of the destruction of the wicked in Psalm 52 that the righteous also shall see and fear and shall laugh at him. That's the wicked person. And they will say, lo, this is the man that made not God his strength, but trusted in the abundance of his riches and strengthened himself in his wickedness. The standards we apply in arriving at our judgments will differ from those standards used by those outside in the world, unenlightened in God's estimation of what constitutes acceptable character. So Paul exhorted the Ephesians to have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. And by coming out from the world, we distance ourselves from the wickedness of the world. Because by unnecessary association with the ways of the ungodly, we become implicated ourselves in their sin. And then verse 4 continues, but he honoureth them that fear the Lord. If we are to abide in God's holy hill, we must be very careful now about the company we keep. We should be attracted to those people who fear the Lord, and those people who think upon his name. And such people are very much in the minority today, aren't they? And with them, we share the same values, the same hope. as the writer of Psalm 119 states. He says, I am a companion of all them that fear thee, and of them that keep thy precepts. And then finally, in this fourth verse, he that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not. New International Version, who keeps his oath even when it hurts. And this precept is based on the law. We read in Numbers that if a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth. Or again in Deuteronomy, when thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not be slack to pay it, for the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin unto thee. In a world that treats promises lightly, when politicians promise the earth, knowing full well that they will never be able to achieve what they say, we must be men and women of our word. If we say we're going to do something, then we must make sure that we are true to our words, even if it hurts. The Revised Standard Version renders Jesus' instruction in the Sermon on the Mount, let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil. And then we move on to the final three clauses in verse 5. He that putteth not out his money to usury. The practice of taking from a fellow Jew interest, exorbitant interest very often, on a loan, was forbidden under the law. The command in Exodus chapter 22 reads in the New International Version, if you lend money to one of my people among you who is needy, do not be like a moneylender. Charge him no interest. And this principle extends beyond monetary matters, because this passage in Exodus continues, if you take your neighbor's cloak as a pledge, return it to him by sunset, because his cloak is the only covering he has for his body. What else will he sleep in? And when he cries out to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. In Ezekiel chapter 18, among the righteous acts that distinguishes the son from the sins of his father are that he hath taken his hand from the poor, that have not received usury, nor increase, have executed my judgments, have walked in my statutes. In contrast, chapter 22 of Ezekiel draws attention to Jerusalem's sins. Thou hast taken usury and increase. Thou hast greedily gained of thy neighbors by extortion, and hast forgotten me, saith the Lord God. Nor taketh reward against the innocent. Other versions, nor taketh a bribe. So we have to avoid exploiting the underprivileged and the helpless. Fairness and even-handedness will be blessed by God. Psalm 112 refers to the blessing of the man that fears the Lord, the man who delights in the Lord's commandments. Such a man will be the recipient of divine favour. And just as he has tried to be godly, showing compassion and love to his neighbour, so God will do the same to him. I'd just like to read a passage from Psalm 112, verse 4. Upon the upright there ariseth light in the darkness. He is gracious and full of compassion and righteous. A good man showeth favour and lendeth. He will guide his affairs with discretion. Surely he shall not be moved for ever. The righteous shall be in everlasting remembrance. He shall not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is fixed, trusting in the Lord. His heart is established. He shall not be afraid until he see his desire upon his enemies. He hath dispersed, he has given to the poor. His righteousness endureth for ever, and his horn shall be exalted in honour. Which brings us to the closing sentence of our psalm, the conclusion to what has gone before. He that doeth these things shall never be moved. And really, we've come full circle. We're back to the opening objective expressed in verse 1, the objective of dwelling permanently in the holy hill. Psalm 125, we think, helps us to understand the stability and the permanence that God is promising the upright man. And the figure that's given, we can very easily relate to. Psalm 125, verse 1. They that trust in the Lord shall be as Mount Zion, which cannot be removed, but abideth forever. As the mountains are round about Jerusalem, so the Lord is round about his people from henceforth even forever. What a wonderful promise to become as unmovable as Mount Zion. The foundations have been set already, just as the mountains have stood from age to age. And it is our hope that we shall be there ourselves in the day when God finally sets his king upon his holy hill of Zion. As the Israel of God, we are now prospective citizens of Zion. We think it is very significant that our psalm has nothing to say about ritual observance as defined in the law. All the examples given are concerned with moral virtues. They relate to the love of God, and they relate to an active love which falls on our neighbours. So what is it that we bring to God as we seek to abide in his tabernacles? The words of the prophet Micah come to mind. Wherewith shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before the high God? Similar questions to the start of our song. Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves of a year old? He continues, he hath showed thee, O man, what is good. And what doth the Lord require of thee? but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. So in Micah's words, we have the essence of Psalm 15 that we've been looking at this evening.